exchange. And if you just want to give us a quick overview of, first of all, for members of the working group, the letter that was submitted is in your packet, this October 4th letter. And there's... It's worth worth reading through, but if you just want to take a minute and give us kind of the high-level gist of or what you perceive as kind of the big issues facing the insurance exchange.
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, Jim Golden, Division Director for Health Policy at the Department of Health. Just to be clear, actually, these comments were not sent by the department
right.
to... the Department of Health and Human Services.
I was assuming everybody understood that. It's been pretty well covered. So.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think kind of quickly what I would say in looking at some of the substance of the materials that were prepared by the agency, I think the letter itself identified what we thought were five very large issues, and it did it in response to a number of questions that had been posed by the Department of Health and Human Services. The first issue is that we wanted to make sure that the Department of Health and Human Services understood that there are many issues that need clarification in order for either the feds or the states to be able to implement the law that was passed. One of the central themes throughout the letter was a strong request for the federal government to provide states the maximum flexibility in trying to implement this so that it was specific to the needs of a state and the market that they were responding to. Additionally, in addition to the flexibility, we were requesting that the Department of Health and Human Services develop some type of mechanism that would engage the states so that we could have an ongoing discussion. So as we had various ideas that we thought fit within whatever guidance they might have, we would have a timely and ongoing mechanism to be able to engage them in that conversation. We think that that is going to be necessary in order for anyone to be able to implement the health insurance exchange. I think the second big issue that you will see is that we were worried about basically the idea of adverse selection. While the federal health reform bill does have a variety of mechanisms for risk adjustment and risk pooling, I think that all of the agencies continue to have a significant concern that these mechanisms may not be adequate or fully address the potential risk adverse risk selection problems. Many of the parameters that need to be defined in the development and setting up of an insurance exchange, if not careful, can lead to adverse risk selection. There's certainly risk selection between plans, but we are particularly concerned about some of the risk selection both inside the exchange and outside the exchange. And I think that we were calling for the states to have maximum flexibility in trying to adapt their insurance market to be able to address those concerns while trying to deal with some of the other issues. The third issue that we identified throughout the letter for a strong need would be the need for the federal government to define their essential benefit set. This is going to be very important. They're going to need to do that early. It's going to be needed for states to be able to do a variety of activities. In order for a state such as Minnesota to evaluate a basic health plan, we're going to need to understand what is in the essential benefit set and how that might be implemented in Minnesota. Also, as we begin to evaluate how Minnesota Care, our current medical assistance program, and other programs interact with the federal law, it will be important for us to understand what that essential benefit set is, as well as we'll need to understand the methodologies that the Department of Health and Human Services is using to set the actuarial value for some of those benefits so that we can think about what any additional benefits might cost. The fourth issue that we strongly suggested that there be some assistance on is that there be some guidance on the Medicaid or medical assistance eligibility process. Specifically, we were looking at a couple of things. We would like to see some federal guidance on what the federal government intends to do to help simplify the eligibility process. Specifically, as we look at trying to move away from paper and align the various eligibility processes across various programs. We're going to need to have that alignment and some guidance on a couple of things. First, what is the role of the state versus the federal government with some of the IT systems? What types of data sources are going to be used to support the eligibility process? We're going to need to know both of those things so we can better understand what our responsibilities are, as well as what time and resources might be needed to deal with some of the eligibility. We also had expressed in the letter some concerns about variations in eligibility between what would be in the Medicaid program as well as the subsidies in the exchange, highlighting that they need to be simplified so that there is a consistent process that applies to eligibility throughout. The final major point that runs throughout the letter is asking the federal government for maximum flexibility in ensuring that states such as Minnesota can integrate whatever activities would be required as part of a health insurance exchange in with our 2008 Minnesota Health Reform Bill. So, for example, there are a number of efforts that were passed in 2008 around measurement, quality measurement, provider peer grouping, and transparency. We wanted to ensure that the federal government provides some flexibility in making sure that we can use that type of quality reporting to help with the market. We also asked for flexibility around care redesign, building on much of the work we have done in Minnesota around healthcare homes. And finally, flexibility on payment reform and network adequacy. We know that in Minnesota we have been working for quite some time to get to global payment. There's been a lot of interest in accountable care organizations, and we want to be able to see that. With regard to the network adequacy, I think it's a balance between allowing enough providers into the network and still allowing health plans and others to be able to have some selective contracting in order to get to high-value providers, which would be, again, consistent with where we were going in our 2008 bill. So I think those were what we would identify as the five biggest issues that were worked throughout the letter in the various questions that we responded to.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Golden, you know that the letter was sent. It wasn't sent by the governor's office. It wasn't sent by the Department of Health, but it was sent. And so now my concern is if Secretary Sebelius would choose to answer any of the questions raised in the letter, how do we get that discussion in the public domain? I think it's important that that the answers should be in the public domain. The letter is now in the public domain.
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, certainly as you point out, the letter is in the public domain. They have been supplied to the Department of Health and Human Services. What they choose to do with that is outside of our control. You know, I think these are issues that we identified as concerns. I think certainly we are prepared to provide any technical assistance we can on that. I think these are issues that have been raised by others as well, so I don't anticipate that this will be the only opportunity to raise these types of concerns.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, do you expect that Secretary Sebelius would be answering the issues that were raised in the letter?
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't... I guess I don't really anticipate Secretary Sebelius to answer this directly. The original request for comments that was published in the Federal Register was for a general request for comments that was intended to be used for HHS to think about their notice of proposed rulemaking around health insurance exchanges, as well as guidance on issues to states. So I would anticipate that all of the comments, whether it was these that were sent to directly to Secretary Sebelius or those that were put in through the comment process, will ultimately be used to inform their either guidance or rulemaking. I don't anticipate any of the comments to be answered directly.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Golden, do you expect there would be directives issued to the states as a result of the comments that we and other states have made?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I would say I certainly hope that there will be guidance to the states on not only the issues that we raised, but issues that others who have looked at some of these concerns have raised as well. As I say, I think either for the states to proceed in developing a health insurance exchange or for the federal government to move forward, they are going to have to think about these issues, and they are going to have to issue some guidance, because otherwise it's going to be very challenging for anyone to move forward on some of these issues. So I do expect that the guidance will address these issues, and I hope soon.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, do you expect that when those advisories would be provided that you would be making them available to this working group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, certainly we would. I would anticipate that guidance to be actually probably public guidance that is issued by the Department of Health and Human Services, either through a federal register or through some other mechanism on their website of healthcare.gov or something like that. But certainly we would track that and be certainly willing to help you know when they're available.
One last question, Senator Mr. Berglund. Chairman, Mr. Golden. The states that have already set up exchanges, how are they complying with the issues that have been raised in the letter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you know, I think there's a variety of ways that they're doing on that. I'm not sure that I have off the top of my head the answer to all of those questions. We would certainly be willing to look. If you have more specific questions, we would take a look at that and provide you whatever information we have. And certainly, and some would be quite a bit simpler to address. So, for example, you could look at what Utah or Massachusetts is doing with regard to some of their risk adjustment and how they have addressed some of the concerns around adverse selection in the exchanges that they have up. I think that there are other questions, for example, about simplifying eligibility and how are the subsidies for the exchange under federal health reform going to work. At this point, they probably haven't addressed that any more than we have, because I think they probably, too, are waiting for some federal guidance on that. So I think some issues have probably been addressed, some have not, but we would certainly be willing to work with you to answer more specific questions that you might have.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Golden, I think it'd be helpful if there are issues that have been raised in the letter that have been addressed by others in their operations so far, that we would get that information from you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we'll take a look at that.
Any other questions? Do you know when the essential benefits set, is there any further update on when they might be issuing regulations on that? You can, if you're going to tell us, okay. If you're going to speak later, you can tell us then, too. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so everybody probably hopefully received by email this a draft of a work plan yesterday. You know, one of the things is we've been thinking about, or I've been thinking about it, I guess, the working group. I think that we haven't been as good as we could have in engaging people in the discussion and having a more full-fledged kind of give and take among all the members of the working group. And, you know, one of the goals of putting out a kind of a more fully developed work plan is so people partly can see where we're going, in part, you know, be prepared to participate, you know, when there's an area that you think is within your expertise more. But one of the things I wanted to start out with is to see if anybody had any things that they think is missing in this work plan, if things don't make sense. And you can also let us, you know that after today's meeting as well, if you haven't had a chance to look it over. But I just wanted to start there and really invite people to, you know, to feel free to engage as much as you wish and kind of speak out on stuff. Further, because, you know, the reason we're all here is to actually have a discussion. Did people get a chance to look at the work plan? Any huge omissions? Okay. Well, why don't we use this as our starting point if people do have thoughts on, even as we're moving along, this can be a working document, obviously, but I think it kind of will give us a guide through where we need to proceed. Okay, well, let's start out then with is Tom doing it? Mr. Pender is going to start with, I think, one of the issues that came up last week in our or last 2 weeks ago, whenever our last meeting was. I think people felt like we didn't have as good an understanding or of the what the possible functions of the exchange could be, which is probably a really good place for us to start. And so that's where we will start. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tom Pender from the House Research Department, and I was asked to speak on the subjects Representative Thiessen just mentioned. I'm going to start with just a little. I'm trying to limit this to about 15 minutes. That's my goal. The federal act, I'm going to call it the Affordable Care Act, requires each state to create a health insurance exchange. It can be a government agency or a nonprofit entity. If a state doesn't do that, the federal government will create an exchange and run an exchange in that state, just as it's done for the high-risk pools for states that didn't choose to operate their own. The federal law requires that the federal HHS department determine by January 1st, 2013, whether the state appears ready to operate an exchange by 2014. And if not, HHS is required to get ready to operate a federal exchange in that state. And presumably they would monitor things during that year and make a decision at some point whether they have to actually do it. I was going to say a little bit about the status of the federal regulations, but that's been discussed here already, so I won't deal with that. What I'm going to be dealing with here is the required and possible optional functions of an exchange once one is operating, and I'm not going to be focusing on broader issues like state versus regional, whether it merges the individual and small employer market, and so on. I think you have my handout. It's a front and back side sheet. The first thing I'm going to cover is the required exchange functions, and the agenda says that we should identify if something similar is being done by a state agency in Minnesota or another organization, and I did that by putting them in parentheses. I sort of had to use my judgment on whether things that an agency was already doing is, you know, significantly close to what they'd be doing under an exchange, and either left it out or put it in. And I'm not going to, as I go through here, I'm not going to refer to the stuff in parentheses about whether a state agency is already doing it. A very important duty of a and all of these things are required that in this first group are specifically required under the federal law. To certify, quote, qualified health plans, close quotes, for participation. And this is partly traditional insurance regulation, but involving both federal and state law, and involves evaluating the entity that's providing the coverage and also each specific product, and the federal law requires a submission of extensive data by a health plan company that wants to be included in the exchange. An exchange is required to provide comparative health plan information, including ratings for price, quality, and enrollee satisfaction. I assume those ratings are going to be extremely hard-fought and controversial. And the rating system is specified in the federal law to be developed by HHS, by the federal government, and not by us. So we don't have that as one of our duties that we have to worry about. We just have to make sure that that rating system is used in Minnesota. The federal law requires exchanges to set up open enrollment and special enrollment periods, similar to what's done for other health plans. Also, the law requires exchanges to administer individual and employer subsidies. And here I'll just mention in the stuff in parentheses about what state agencies are doing, an additional thing that DHS did was to administer the state COBRA subsidies that I think is the program that I think has recently expired. An exchange is required to determine eligibility and facilitate enrollment for Medicaid and private plans, and to also evaluate individual applicants and grant them certifications prove that they're exempt from the individual coverage requirement, the individual mandate for one, and also required to transfer to the Internal Revenue Service and federal HHS information on those who are eligible for subsidies or exempt from a coverage requirement or no longer enrolled in coverage. And a related kind of thing is to communicate with employers and provide employers with the names of employees who are eligible for individual subsidies based on their the information they provide to the exchange. The exchange is required to use an electronic interchange to share information with state and federal agencies, and also to operate a toll-free telephone hotline and website for customer service. And this includes having an online calculator that allows a person who's checking on their eligibility and being interested in being covered to determine their eligibility for premium tax credits and other subsidies, and let them then see what their net cost would be of getting coverage under whatever plans are available to them through the exchange. Also in the material in parentheses here, I could add that DHS has been working on a web-based information system, an online application system, but I gather they haven't yet made that operational. Another requirement of the federal law is that exchanges establish what's called a navigator program, and this is basically a program envisioned to be performed mostly by nonprofit organizations who would give give consumers advice and information on products that could be purchased either presumably through the exchange or not, and I think is partly to avoid having the exchange be put in the position of giving individualized advice that of the kind that's now provided by insurance agents. The federal law specifies that people participating in the Navigator program can't be paid by insurance companies that end up enrolling people who were given advice by that navigator. And I think this program in particular, I think, is something that we'll sort of have to wait and see what it looks like or what the federal rules say about it. A final duty of an exchange, and this is one I realized should be included after I prepared this handout, is that the exchange must publish its administrative and other costs so that the public can see how much the exchange is costing, and the exchange is authorized to recover these costs as part of the what it charges for coverage.
Can we let's just stop there for a minute, see if people have questions on. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had two questions. The first one's on the fourth bullet point. When you're talking about the exchange administering individual and employer subsidies, you have here that DHS will do the individual subsidies. Do you know who's going to do the employer ones, and is it going to be done at the state or federal level?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Rattel, this is the stuff in parentheses is simply an indication of what things are now being done by state agencies and isn't a prediction of who's going to be performing these functions. So in other words, in the bullet point you asked about, this just says that is intended to say that individual subsidies for Minnesota Care enrollees are now administered by DHS. So the agenda asked to have shown what things an exchange will be doing that are now done by some state agency. So that's what these things mean.
So we may choose someone else to do both individual and employer subsidies.
Okay. Does it have to be done at the state level, or could it be done? I mean, is it something that, like, when employers are filing their taxes, it could be done from the federal government, or is that still completely up in the air?
Senator Berg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the federal subsidies that exist for small employers today would be administered by the Internal Revenue Service and would be known by accountants, so that you would provide that information to your accountant at the time you do your taxes.
Okay,
but if we had an exchange, it would be a lot easier for employers to figure out how much their insurance would actually cost them in the beginning when they're deciding whether to have any or not.
Right. And just to follow up, Senator Berglund, this is actually a question we've gotten from a lot of our members already, of where do we go, who are we supposed to be looking at? So seeing it on here, that was why I was trying to see if there was an actual answer yet. And then my other question was the bullet point about provide employers a name of employees eligible for individual subsidies. How is that going to interact with HIPAA, and how is that not going to violate any of the HIPAA requirements?
Mr. Penn.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Rattel, I don't know. I've heard other people ask that same question, and I don't know the answer to it. I haven't heard an answer from anyone else either.
Okay, thank you.
Well,
Senator Bergman.
It seems to me that when you're administering subsidies for insurance premiums, that's different than providing someone with actual health care. You know, it's... We administer for Minnesota Care right now premium subsidies. We're not in violation of HIPAA in doing so.
So there's no medical information being disclosed except that you are getting a subsidy. So, but why do employers need that information? Not that we can do anything about it, but I just don't.
I think you're not eligible for a subsidy from the federal government if you're eligible for employer coverage.
But it seems like that information would want to flow the other direction. Ms. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, that there is circumstances in which penalties for the employers are determined based on whether or not somebody who is eligible for subsidy goes to the exchange and gets a subsidy. So it would need it to be known for terms of whether or not an employer may be fined.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the other thing is that some people don't make enough even being employed, so they would be eligible for subsidies. And so somehow you would have to have a way of documenting that population. The employer may not know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of questions. On the fourth bullet, it says determine eligibility and facilitate enrollment for Medicaid and private plans. Some of the literature I've read seems to indicate that this is a broader requirement than just health, and that the exchange be able to facilitate enrollment for other government benefits, like cash assistance. And I'm wondering if you have looked at that or don't agree with that, or?
Mr. Chair and Ms. O'Connell, I guess I haven't thought about that.
Okay.
And I don't know.
I can get you some more information on that.
So are you saying it would be required by the federal law as opposed to an option that we could pursue?
Yes.
Okay. That would be helpful to get.
I mean, I'm just talking about requirements.
Yeah.
And other requirements that I've read about that I don't see in your list, and again, a couple of these things are not what I see that you have here, Mr. Pinder, is the list of specific items mentioned in the statute. And a couple of these other functions that I've seen mentioned are kind of as a result of other federal statutes and how they would interplay with the exchange. And so I have seen that one of the functions would be creating and administering an appeals process when people are denied tax credits and reasons, and so you'd have to have a due process appeals process
within the exchange,
as part of the exchange. Or you could, of course, just like with Medicaid eligibility, you could contract with another state agency, but we are going to have an appeals function. And the other requirement that that I don't really see reflected at all, but is the requirement to provide materials to comply with all the anti-discriminatory laws and to provide information in multiple languages, all the LEP requirements. So those are just a couple of additional functions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Berglund, I also have a question about bullet number two. If there's thought about having comparative ratings for quality about the enrollment in the public programs, if this is an opportunity for us to do that. Currently, it's about a 90-day wait to access Minnesota Care or for approval, and that's quite a while. So as we look at the whole bucket of potential for people to be covered, we should have a standard measure for how effective and efficient it is. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Berger.
I might just add that state law requires the Minnesota Care applications to be processed within 30 days. The department tells us that they are being processed within 30 days for all of the applications for which they have all the information that is needed within 30 days.
I'll follow up with my experience.
I understand your experience, and I understand that generally, the public does not view what the department tells us they're doing in the same way the department views it.
Thank you for your response.
Any other questions that people have on this? So you made a mention in the Navigator that it's primarily supposed to be provided by nonprofit organizations. What is that in the federal requirement? I mean, in thinking about, in terms of the Navigator being, one possibility would be county workers, right, serving as a navigator, I suppose, since they do a lot of that work for public programs, program clients right now. And then it also appears that brokers can't be a navigator because they would be selling insurance that's sold through the exchange.
Mr. Chair, the second question, I think brokers could
well, that was
do
what
it,
I
but
thought.
They can't. They can't be compensated based on coverage that they arrange or recommend for people through the exchange. So, for instance, a retired insurance broker, for instance, who's still licensed, would be able to do it if they're not selling for any particular company could do it, but it can't be simply a broker doing it in their ordinary course of business where they get paid a commission by whoever they assist the person in signing up with.
What about selling outside the exchange? Can they get commissions for that, or is it so there's no prohibition on being a broker selling outside the exchange and getting a commission? It's just within the exchange.
That's correct. Right.
Okay. Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Terry, I just want to clarify, and maybe it's something that Mr. Pinder could confirm, just a little bit of nuance of what you just said. My understanding is the broker cannot be paid for selling a product through the exchange by the exchange, but a broker potentially could be paid by the insurer for a product sold within the It's gray in the law. I think there's many different interpretations of that.
Mr. Munson-Ragala, do you want to? And we are going to get to this is an overview, too. We're trying to get questions out. And we are going to address this issue specifically later on in the work plan. But this is helpful to do right now. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, actually, Ms. Coleman, I think he got it backwards. It's the other way around. So a broker, like any other navigator, can get paid by the exchange. So the exchange could pay each navigator a per enrollee fee. If they want to receive commission, they have to do it outside the exchange. So a broker can be a navigator. They just can't get a commission. They have to be paid by the exchange.
Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Munson-Ragala, so would that be a one-time fee that the exchange would pay, like an enrollment fee rather than a commission?
Madam Chair, I believe it could be, I think it would be up to the exchange on how they want to structure that fee. If I understand the way Utah does it, they do it on an annual basis per enrollee.
Well, I understand the way Utah does it, and I find it offensive. They pay a broker, whether anybody ever talked to a broker or not. Every single person enrolled in their exchange, there is a broker that is paid a commission, whether you just were on the computer and never talked to a broker.
Well, we'll have to sort that through. Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure, doesn't the statute talk about grants too? So it's a grant process, right? Has the grant process been, there hasn't been any guidance yet, right? Okay. And so I was contemplating more of like a grant to an entity or to a broker. Like
grants to Portico.
Yeah, to Portico or to our organization gets a grant. Legal Aid gets a grant to help people enroll. But so the grant could either be a lump sum or it could be a payment per application, or so it could be any of those, right?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Collins, that's correct. Absent guidance, I don't think we know what grants means in this context.
Okay.
But you're right. It could be on some baseline lump sum plus some number dependent on the number of successful enrollees you have.
Senator Burley.
And Mr. Munson-Ragala, could the navigator be employed by the exchange so that people that don't have access to computers or don't understand how to operate through the program would be able to just talk to somebody on the phone at the exchange? Would that type of person also be considered a navigator?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, that might fall more under the sort of customer service category, so you might not need to designate them as a navigator. The exchange is supposed to have folks on the 800 line, for example, to help folks through the enrollment process. So they might serve the certain purpose as a navigator, but they wouldn't have to be designated as such. They would just be customer service representatives for the exchange.
Just be doing their job.
So are navigators then supposed to be more like outreach workers that get people enrolled to have the insurance that they're required to have?
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, conceptually, I think navigators are meant to be different ways to access the exchange programs. So depending on the population or the way that folks access it, there should ideally be someone who can help them through that process. And it might be as simple as insurance 101. To some populations, they don't know what they're buying. So it might be as simple as explain what a policy is, what premiums are intended to cover, how deductibles work, answering sort of those baseline questions so they understand when they get to the screen or the template where they start screening or answering questions to make a determination. That could be the function a navigator serves.
Senator Bruin.
One more question, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Munson-Ragala. When you call and talk to someone at an exchange who is doing customer service, does that person have to be able to speak in various languages?
Madam Co-Chair, I think that would be dependent on the exchange. I would assume that would be a helpful customer service function. Functionality you'd want is to provide the ability to deal with the diversity that's in our state, but I think that would be an exchange decision to make.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Berglund, in the community health center world, there is a federally required function called advocacy services. And part of advocacy services are individuals who help people enroll for Minnesota Care, et cetera. Not necessarily select from an array of options, but there is some experience in the state already for that. So if that would be helpful, it's one of the designated functions and required functions of being a community health center.
My apologies.
Well, I think it's also probably going to be required of this operation because people that are eligible for Medicaid come to the exchange under the federal law, as I understand it, and they are determined whether they're eligible for Medicaid or for tax credits, and they're going to have to be able to have people that speak different languages in order to help people to do that under federal law.
Madam Chair, my apologies. My partner in crime does remind me there is a provision in PAPACA that requires exchanges to be able to service diverse communities. So I assume we'll be waiting for guidance on what that means from a functionality standpoint.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Berglund, I believe that what I have seen is the people at the exchange may not have to do it themselves, but they could use a vendor, you know, a language line or something like that, but they do need to make it available to assist people.
You could contract it out.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if maybe Mr. or someone, I don't know who it is, the IT piece of this, we don't know right now in terms of like the website for customer service and the electronic interchange, whether that's going to be federally developed or state developed. We're still waiting to hear on that. Okay. All right. All right. Why don't we move on to the potential additional functions?
Okay. I'll just mention one more thing on the Navigator program, which I think is the language of the federal law reminds me of things I end up drafting sometime when it's very hard to get agreement on anything and you kind of make it sort of wishy-washy. give everybody a little piece of something they want. So I hope that the federal regulations will clarify. We'll clarify what the Congress didn't. On potential additional exchange functions, and these are basically things that are not mentioned within the federal law as things that exchanges might do, but they're not things that are prevented, that are things that exchanges are not permitted to do. The first one, which may turn out to be the most important, is that an exchange can act as a negotiator or contract administrator in dealing with health plan companies and qualified health plans, or they can do sort of like Utah does and sort of act as a passive recipient of information from entities that want to sell coverage, but the wording of the federal law allows scope for exchanges to negotiate with insurers that want their products included in the exchange and negotiate on premium rates or try to get them to cover a little bit more things or change the wording in their contract. And this is basically then making the exchange more of a purchaser or a selector of coverage and not requiring them to necessarily let just any plan be sold through the exchange, even if it meets the minimum requirements in the federal law. And the language that permits this is in the definition in the federal law of qualified health plan, which includes a determination by the exchange that making this health plan available through the exchange is, quote, in the interest of qualified individuals and qualified employers in the state. So one could use that language, for instance, an exchange could use that language to decide, for instance, you know, someone comparing this health plan with the others available, no rational person would choose this health plan. So it's not in the interest of employers or individuals, and therefore we're not going to allow it. Or presumably an exchange could not want to take that role and simply say, well, it's in the best interest of purchasers to, you know, be allowed to buy whatever they choose to buy, and we're not going to substitute their judgment for ours. But anyway, there is language that does allow the exchange to take that kind of active role. Another potential duty of an exchange is to conduct risk adjustment for plans inside and outside the exchange. And I know this is something that your group is going to be covering in a future meeting, so I'm not going to spend time on it, but just to mention that is something that is required in the Affordable Care Act, but it's not specified as an exchange duty. So it is something that needs to be done by some entity in connection with the state's plan. Going on to the
Representative Huntley had a question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Pinder, I'm just a little wondering about the setting up the risk adjustment inside and outside the exchange. I thought the intent was to not overly regulate things that were outside the exchange.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, that's correct, but the law does require that that risk adjustment be done to
on both sides.
From one direction to another.
And my understanding is we could not have outside the exchange too, right?
Mm-mm.
Is that not an option?
You have to have outside the exchange, I believe, Mr. Chairman. Not every group will be receiving a subsidy. Not every group would necessarily be purchasing through an exchange.
Well, not every group can, but, I thought there was, anyway, okay.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair and Mr. Pender, you know, if we move to accountable care organizations, the risk adjustment is going to be a hugely important issue and also very controversial.
Mr. Penn.
Mr. Chair, going to the back page of my handout, one thing that exchanges could do, it's not prevented by the federal laws, to provide comparative health care provider information on cost, quality, and enrollee satisfaction. So this is going beyond the insurer and going down one level to look at the providers that are covered by that insurer.
Just to step back on the risk adjustment, and I know we'll get back to that, but that could be like the Department of Commerce could do that work as well, or some. I mean, that's the idea here, is that some other agent entity could do that work?
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Then the final two items here on the list are simply to recognize that the federal law doesn't actually explicitly require the exchange to collect premiums or to aggregate multiple funding sources, for instance, from multiple employers, and those would be logical things for an exchange to do, but they're not explicitly required under the federal law. So that's the end of my presentation.
That's Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pender, would it also be possible that an exchange might administer other employee benefits on behalf of employers besides health insurance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I can't think of anything in the Affordable Care Act that would prevent that. So I don't, you know, unless the federal regulations somehow deal with that. But I don't know of any. I haven't heard that. I guess I haven't heard that suggestion before. But I don't know of anything that would prevent it.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund and Mr. Pender. I think that is something that we should explore first within the health arena, but then others. I mean, for example, many employers offer flexible spending benefits where you can save up money tax-free to pay out-of-pocket costs. And, you know, since they're going to be already getting payroll deductions potentially from small employers and aggregating that with a potentially a public subsidy and the employer contribution, you know, putting those things together, one of the major barriers for many employers stepping into the market is that, you know, just complexity and confusion and administrative demands of some of these other sorts of things. So there might be some options with that. The other thing I've heard of is states considering and designing even some of their current computer systems to have one-stop outreach and enrollment, not just for Medicaid, but for other associated programs that are just based on a confirmation of income. And that could be the WIC program. It could be SNAP, the food benefit programs. It could be the free and reduced price lunches, where right now we have multiple outreach programs, multiple enrollment programs. If we're going to invest a lot of money into a new enrollment process, this could actually be maybe more cost effective than having our siloed programs. And I think that's something that we should ponder as we look at designing for eligibility. And I think I was out of the room briefly, but I think the idea of the consumer and small business education that Mr. Regala mentioned, I think, is an important function as well, because there's just a lot of people who don't understand the difference between a copay and a deductible. And, I mean, just they're not going to be able to make an informed choice unless someone kind of does 101. And some of them will choose to use a navigator or a broker to understand that, but others are going to want to just go online and learn and get it done on their own. They have, and if they can do that, why hire staff to do it?
Yeah, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pender, I've got a question regarding the role of the purchaser. That doesn't strike me to agree with the prohibition against premium price setting, and that when the legislation talks about the certification process, it prohibits premium price setting. And it seems to me, if you're going to be purchasing something, that you're by definition setting a price. You're bargaining a price in that purchase agreement. And by bargaining a price, you're then setting the price.
Mr. Pender, if you have a...
I haven't looked at that in quite a while, and I don't feel like I can answer that question right now.
Representative Laughlin.
One other function that's a little bit beyond consumer education that's a possibility, and that is just helping simplify the market so that it's more understandable and more competitive, and that you might have, in addition to comparable information about products, you know, you'll go to a table and say what your out-of-pocket is and what your copay and what your maximums are or whatever, you could have actually comparable products. And it could be that it could start from the user's choice of saying, I want a maximum out-of-pocket cost of $2,000 or including premiums or in addition to premiums and, you know, what is out there. And it would come back with any, you know, the products that meet that criteria, as opposed to having to scroll through a whole bunch of things trying to find amongst 50 products the ones that happen to meet those kind of affordability standards. And so there's some different ways that the electronic interface might sort out and simplify the market for someone who is purchasing, which is a different function, but it might make it more user-friendly for people who have particular price targets or particular, you know, targets that they want to meet with in narrowing the options.
So, and Mr. Nelson, so that's in the definition of qualified health plan, the premium?
It's in the part of the legislation that says what the certification should be doing, and that's a prohibition that says, I believe it says something to the effect of, through the certification process, there's a prohibition against price controls or price setting or something of that regard. I can find it.
No, that's, I just, okay, that's helpful. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Pender, in the interest of having an exhaustive list of other possible functions, I was going to add the possibility of standardizing the products, as Representative Loeffler suggested. Another one that I understand in Massachusetts anyway was a pretty significant expenditure, especially at the beginning of the rollout of their connector, was just marketing, public marketing, to increase the take-up on this program.
Ms. Coleman?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Pender, I have a question for you on the requirements that I believe starting in 2015, the exchange has to be self-sustaining, so it has to somehow pay for itself. And I know that's one of the agenda items on a future date meeting. But the question I had then is, if you're looking at perhaps expanding the purpose of the exchange, so you're adding some, you know, whether it be food stamps or other programs, and that's something that is funded through government right now, can part of the exchange be self-sustaining, the government providing a grant to take some of those things on, or would the exchange somehow have to assess products to pay for that? So I guess I'm just curious in what you've read, what the definition of the exchange being, you know, self-sustaining itself financially means.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Coleman, I don't think there's anything in the federal law directly dealing with that, because it really doesn't address the exchange taking on more you know, taking on voluntarily things that it's not required to do. But in I guess logically, I think the most logical interpretation of the self-sustaining requirement would be that it has to be self-sustaining for the things that it's required to do by federal law, and if it wants to do something else, it could get funding for that from other sources. I don't see that would I think that would be more in spirit with the federal law, but maybe the long-awaited regulations will provide guidance on that, or as everyone's always saying, guidance is forthcoming.
Representative Powell? Well, I mean, this gets into a tough issue, but I would be opposed to taking what we now spend to administer WIC and food stamps and other things and transferring it to healthcare premiums that everybody has to pay. If the state's paying for those things now out of general state revenues, they ought to stay that way. That doesn't mean that the exchange can't do that. But I don't think we ought to transfer that cost to healthcare premiums.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bender, a lot of talk's been around the Navigator, and we're going to eventually have to get to what's a fair price for them. Question I have is, how about if we do some fact-finding? Right now, I was told we have 2,000 government employees right now that are Navigators, that are putting people in government programs right now. And whatever that cost is for those 2,000, divided by the number of people that you actually enroll, that would give us a annual cost per enrollee. So then that would at least give us some guidance of, you know, so we have 2,000 employees, the cost is $2 million, and you have 1 million individuals that you're enrolling. So we know it costs $2 per person. So my question here is, can we get data to show what the cost of those 2,000 employees are right now, and then divide that into the number of new applicants that they process, that they were actually successful at enrolling? Because in the aging community, we do not get paid unless we're successful. If we work hard and hard and hard and don't get anybody enrolled, we starve. So here it would just be nice to, you know, actually see what the government is currently spending per successful enrollee into a government program right now.
And I don't know if that's for Mr. Pender, maybe for the department to see if it's probably DHS, and I don't even so. Well, and the counties, I mean, who do most of this work. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if we can actually break it down so that, because there really is no intention that a health insurance exchange would be enrolling elderly or disabled people into Medicaid. And those are much more difficult much lengthier enrollment forms. So I don't know if they could break it down as to how much they spend enrolling families with children as opposed to those other populations or not. But
okay.
We'll have a conversation with the department to see what we can come up with and maybe do something with all those caveats as well.
Yeah, it could just be a guidance to have an idea of where we're currently at right now.
Yes.
Thank you.
Right. Ms. O'Connell, maybe he's going to say that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm not saying it's related to
I wanted to express kind of my concern that I think Senator Berglund has expressed that I'm the only thing I'm reluctant about with a statistic like that is that you're not really comparing apples to apples, because our system right now is designed in some ways, as Senator Berglund a while ago said, is designed to keep people out. And so, and the new system, as Senator Berglund said, you know, assumes you're in the box. And so there's a very different assumptions underlying the systems. So we could do it, I'm sure, based on the, I'm sure that 2,000 figure is from the county report that was done a while ago. But also, I think that 2,000 people is working on not only health, but child support, cash assistance, I mean, across all the government benefit programs. So,
I represent Huntley.
I'll pass.
Any other questions about this, this document, about the functions? And what is this? What is this chart? Is that one we prepared? That's one you prepared.
No, Mr. Chair. This comes from, probably Mr. Munson-Regala.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Locke.
Mr. Chair, there's just one other thing that you can tell what I do for a living. But I think that one of the functions that we should accommodate in our planning is an evaluation function, too, in terms of how effective it is in getting people in, what the customer satisfaction is between, you know, the small businesses and the individuals served. And, you know, it's not one of the new startup sort of things, but I think it's one thing that will assure that over time it continues to get better and better.
That's a good point. Okay. So as you look at the, you know, look through the work plan, you'll see that kind of one of the things that we're going to be doing going forward is well, there's two things. And for the required pieces, we'll figure out how prescriptive we want to be in terms of legislation and saying what it's going to be, or whether we leave the development of a particular idea to the exchange to develop. And so that'll be a discussion we do have along the lines. And then for some of these, we'll actually have very specific discussions about them in subsequent meetings. This is really to kind of get questions out there and overview. So if you do have other fact questions or other questions about these functions that you think you need more information about, let Dan Pollock, I guess, know. Or you can email me, and I can forward it on, and we'll make sure that we get that information gathered as well. Were you folks going to talk about this piece? Okay, let's do that then.
Partners in crime.
Welcome to the committee, the working group. It's coming. All right. So, this chart too?
It'll be the last.
The end of it. Okay, great.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we're going to walk you through a little bit about adverse selection, sort of adverse selection 101. And I apologize for those of you who know this stuff inside and out. This will be fairly elementary. We'll talk a little bit about what tools are currently used in the marketplace to minimize adverse selection. We're going to talk about what provisions are in PPACA to deal with adverse selection. And lastly, we're going to talk, and that's the handout you have, sort of general roles the exchange can play and how that might impact this very issue of adverse selection. All right. So adverse selection, in a nutshell, is the tendency of higher-risk people or persons to buy coverage more than less-risky persons or groups. Or as the economist puts it, it's the tendency of people that you don't want to buy insurance to buy insurance from you. So if you are at risk, you might consider that buying an insurance policy is a really good idea. If you are not at risk, you may think there is no value proposition there. Why is that a problem for insurance companies? And we'll talk about that a little bit. There's essentially the problem of, and I'm going to jump down to the third bullet, information asymmetry. The folks that know what their risk level is don't necessarily want to share the information with the folks who are in the business of trying to aggregate or price for that risk. Now, the separation of risk can occur when you, the minute you start setting up different benefit designs. For example, if you have a benefit structure that provides robust coverage for smoking cessation and a different plan that doesn't, you may suspect you might get more smokers for the one that has smoking cessation in there. Since you would expect smokers may bring you more claims, you may see the losses piling up in the plan with designed to appeal to smokers. If you have a plan designed to cover, I don't know, say, bungee accidents, you may get a higher level or a different risk profile than you would for a plan that didn't offer that kind of provision. So one of the things you want to think about when you talk about adverse selection is when you start setting up different plans, different markets, different benefit structures that can result in different risk profiles. All right, so we talked about this information asymmetry is what drives adverse selection. And why is it a problem? Well, here's the problem. If the folks who buy the product are the folks who need the product, the claims go up, and the losses go up, and the prices go up. That means the folks who are healthy in health insurance, who feel that they have less at risk, will continue to drop off the plan. They'll make the assessment, I don't have to buy the product anymore. So the losses go further up, and they get more expensive, and the only folks who stay in are the ones who need the product. So that's when you're basically talking about a death spiral. All right, so here are the tools that currently are being used to deal with adverse selection. The first one is medical underwriting, right? It's to deal with information asymmetry. You ask questions about people's medical histories so you can get a better sense and a more accurate sense of what medical risk they pose to you as an underwriter. A second way you can deal with adverse selection is to be sure everyone's in the pool. Mandatory purchase. You can say everyone has a product, therefore there isn't the opportunity to gain the product. You know, if everyone has to purchase, then the pool will be more reflective of an average risk than it otherwise would be. You could apply pre-existing exclusions, and similarly, you could apply waiting periods. You could say, we'll take everything but the areas that pose the greatest risk to us. And again, that minimizes the ability for folks to buy a product, as the analogy I've heard before, when the house is burning down. So you can say, we'll sell you that product after the fire is put out. And lastly, you could also say open enrollment periods could serve as a purpose of minimizing adverse selection. Open enrollment periods typically are offered in conjunction with guaranteed issue. So you could say that if there's going to be guaranteed issue, it all happens at the same time so that no one plan is put at risk for having a higher than what you would expect proportionate share of high-risk patients. Now we're going to switch to, so what's in PPACA to deal with adverse selection?
Mr. and Madam Chair and members of the work group, my name is April Todd-Malmuth. I'm the State Health Economist and Director of the Health Economics Program. So the next we're going to talk about why adverse selection is of concern for exchanges. The main concern is that when you have characteristics of products that are offered inside and outside a market or a pool that are different, That can lead to separation of risk. If you have risk that's separated, it can lead to those inside or outside the pool being in a different risk profile, so you have a different amount of claims that are in there. That can lead to higher or differential premiums inside and outside the exchange that continue to attract different type of people over time and over time. So one pool, the premiums just get higher and higher, and it gets lower and lower enrollment, and it leads to issues that Mr. Munson-Rogala was talking about. Regarding a death spiral. Now, a very good example of this are the purchasing pools that many states enacted in the 1990s. Minnesota had one of them. Many other states also had them. The problem here was that you had the outside market and the purchasing pools. The characteristics between the two are very different. So they had different risk pools, they had different rules, and it had a mobile population. So you had people who could go inside or outside the pool. They could just pick wherever it is that they wanted to go. So it's not like a stable population that you have with employer-based coverage where the person's there and that's the purchasing pool and they really don't move very often, so you can negotiate that. But this is a mobile population. They can move. And so what you had and what you ended up getting was a death spiral. So you had people inside the pool that ended up just getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and the premiums kept going up and up and up, and then you have less and less enrollment. And so those pools eventually died over time because they couldn't sustain a healthy risk pool. So what PPACA does to try to address this, and there's a few things that it does specifically to address this problem that happened in the past. First is that it creates a single risk pool inside and outside the exchange. Now what that means is that as in the past where you had separate risk pools inside and outside the exchange where you could base premiums on the risk profile of the person in the pool, within the exchange, you, inside and outside the exchange, whether or not you're in there, the risk pool is the same. So there, it's not separate for the exchange versus the outside market. So all of those people, depending on whether they're healthy or not, are in the same risk pool, whether or not they're in the exchange or not. Another thing that PPACA does to minimize adverse selection is it sets up a minimum benefit level. So you can't create a situation where you set up a very high level of benefits within a pool, like what happened with the purchasing pool, versus outside a pool. So you attract certain healthy risk outside, and you could have unhealthy risk inside because they're attracted to certain types of benefits. With the establishment of a minimum benefit set, it reduces the likelihood of adverse selection. That's one thing.
And that's a minimum benefit set that applies inside and outside.
Yes. So the essential benefit set that applies to the individual in the small group market, that applies inside and outside the exchange. It applies to everyone.
And what about premiums and deductibles and co-pays? Out-of-pocket costs, can that be higher outside the exchange?
Mr. Chair, the actuarial value levels, so that the bronze, gold, silver, platinum plans, those requirements for actuarial value levels also apply the same way inside and outside the exchange. They don't only apply inside the exchange.
Could you have an even lower or an even higher deductible plan outside the exchange?
Mr. Chair, you could, as long as it would fall within a particular actuarial value level. And that's actually one of the key issues that we'll talk about on some later slides. So.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Todd Malmlov, how can the risk be the same in both sides? Because everybody that's getting a subsidy will have to be in the exchange, which means they're basically lower income than people still outside the exchange. And health is directly related to income. And so why wouldn't you get more sicker people in the exchange?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm actually going to, if it's okay, I'll defer that question to the next slide because it'll explain how the rating would work under that scenario. Another thing that applies both inside and outside the exchange that didn't apply in the past with purchasing pools is that the rating and the underwriting rules are the same inside and outside the exchange. So the modified community rating requirements, the guarantee issue requirements, so the 3-to-1 rating for age, the 1.5-to-1 rating for tobacco, all of those rating requirements, they apply to plans inside the exchange and outside the exchange. So the rules are the same inside and outside. So that's another thing that mitigates adverse selection. A fourth thing is that if a plan offers the same product inside the exchange versus outside the exchange, they have to charge the same premium. The law does not require that a plan have to offer the same plans inside and outside the exchange, but if they do, they have to charge the same premium. Another thing that will reduce selection.
Is that an option for us to require that the same products be available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, it is. Another thing is related to exchange subsidies. That is a way too in which it can avoid adverse selection for exchanges. And this addresses the issue of a mobile population. So it reduces the ability for people to go inside and outside the exchange to get the cheaper product. If the subsidies are only available in the exchange, then that keeps that population in the exchange more constant. At least keeps a base of a population in the exchange since they can only get the subsidies there. And lastly, another provision that mitigates adverse selection or attempts to deal with the back end of adverse selection or correct that for health plans is the risk adjustment that applies inside and outside the exchange.
Senator Berglund.
Ms. Todd-Mollock, isn't there also a provision for stop-loss coverage for plans that might experience more than a certain amount of loss after the program goes into effect?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, yes, that's really referred to as the reinsurance mechanism. Mm-hmm. The reason I didn't put it on here is that it is a temporary mechanism, so it is only in place through 2014 through 2016. But it's in there in those 3 years to help mitigate some of the change that states will see with the change in rating rules over time.
But during that three-year period, if you saw that for some reason this was something that was being used by a company, then you could figure out what you're doing that was causing there to be a problem for that company as opposed to other companies, and you could make adjustments in the rules of your exchange and the products being offered outside your exchange.
Yes, Madam Chair. So the reinsurance mechanism is designed to, in a sense, reimburse those plans that attract more unhealthy risk.
And we're going to get into that next hearing too, a little more detail, I think.
So on this,
there's one more, another question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. Todd, can you describe or make a comment about whether the risk adjustment is a proactive risk adjustment or a retrospective risk adjustment, and how that would affect?
Mr. Chair and member of the committee. The risk adjustment, the provisions around risk adjustment are, again, one of those things that our guidance is forthcoming mechanisms.
We don't know.
But there are discussions that are occurring between the states around the need to consider a proactive versus a react or a retrospective type of risk adjustment mechanism and whether or not one is better than the other and whether or not it may be helpful to have both.
Okay.
So on this slide, this explains how the single risk pooling mechanism would work, essentially. There's probably a few more details here, but this is a pretty simplified version of how a single risk pool could work. So as I was describing earlier, under PPACA, insurers must include all individual market plans in the same risk pool inside and outside the exchange, and all small group market plans inside and outside the exchange in the same risk pool. So essentially how this works is an insurer would first look at the whole bucket of risk that they have in their individual market, for example, and look at the trend and look at the type of risk that they have in their market to determine what is going to be the base rate or the base price that I would have for individuals in that plan. Secondly, they can make adjustments for that base pricing to adjust for product characteristics. So a different type of network, different types of benefits, if it's a silver plan, a gold plan, those types of things, make adjustments for what the characteristics of the product are on top of that base trend for the whole market. Thirdly, they could adjust for assumed risk selection and actual risk experience of individual products. So the law prevents health status rating for individuals. It does not prevent risk rating for a product or for a group of products. And so you could have products, for example, as as the chair was saying, inside and outside the exchange, that could be different and attract a different type of risk selection that would be allowed under the law. And lastly, they could adjust for modified community rating factors such as age, geography, and wellness discounts for individual enrollees. So that's the process in which they could set up a premium rating structure for individuals inside and outside the exchange in the same risk pool. The one thing to keep in mind here, and this leads into the next slide, is that if there are differences between an exchange and the outside market related to these four areas, this is where you can get adverse selection to occur even though you have the same risk pool. And there's a few key things we'll point out on the next slide, which are things to keep in mind going forward, even though you do have the same risk pool. The first one, so related to basing pricing for all products on the trend of the whole market. One issue with this that is not addressed by PPACA is that PPACA does not require insurers to participate both inside and outside the exchange. For example, this is an issue, for example, where you could have insurers that could have one subsidiary that operates inside an exchange and another subsidiary that operates outside the exchange. In a sense, what this would be doing is it would be allow the company, through their subsidiaries, to segment their risk. And so they could set up products and set up a mechanism where they would attract, for example, sicker risk in the exchange, healthier risk outside the exchange, and they wouldn't have to put them in the same risk pool. That's an issue of concern to be aware of.
And we can, I mean, this is what Representative Loeffler asked, but we can require that if you offer products outside the exchange that you also have to offer them inside the exchange? Can we
do it? Mr. Chair, yes, you can do that. The second issue related to adjusting for product characteristics. The issue here is that PPACA, as I was describing earlier, requires plans inside an exchange but not outside an exchange to be certified. And there are rules that HHS will design for certified plans around, in particular, network adequacy. This is an issue where you could have different rules for provider networks that exist inside the exchange versus outside the exchange. If that is the case, you will have different rules that have a very big impact on product pricing for which providers can be inside and outside your product that would be different inside and outside the exchange. And if that's the case, that's another way that you can be segmenting risk. So that's another thing to keep in mind as well.
So you'd have a small network of high-quality, low-cost providers, arguably. I mean, that's what you're talking about? Or that you had limited to certain providers and people would... Okay.
I'll give you an example, Mr. Chair. The federal government, for example, could come back and say that one of the certification requirements for a health plan in the exchange is that they accept any willing provider.
Right. Okay.
And if that's the case, then there would be little motivation for providers to, you know, work to try to improve their quality because they would be, you know, have to be offered in the plan if they wanted to. If that was the case inside the exchange and we were doing Minnesota health reforms outside the exchange that are encouraging that, you kind of see where the problem is.
Yes.
There.
Yes, okay.
The third issue to be wary of is related to adjustment for assumed risk selection and actual risk experience of individual products. And this is where, even though you have the same risk pool, if you have different products inside and outside the exchange that are attracting different types of risk, and you're allowed to price your products based on the risk of those products, you will attract different type of people, and you'll have different premiums inside and outside the exchange that could attract different kinds of risk, higher premiums over time, death spiral, that same scenario that you could get under that purchasing pool arrangement. There are a couple of different ways to address this. The first is that you could prevent insurers from allowing pricing based on assumed or actual risk experience in those products. So they would not be able to use that in their pricing. That's actually something that is done today by the state of Connecticut with their community rating program. So it's something you could do. The other thing that you could do is to require all health plans inside to offer all products inside and outside the exchange. That's also a recommendation that was in the 2008 health insurance exchange study that you have all products inside and outside the exchange. Part of the reason for that is that even if you prohibited health plans from basing products on actual or assumed risk selection, it's a little unclear at the moment whether or not you could adequately separate the trend that you're getting based on product differences for network and benefits versus the selection that you're getting, and whether or not regulators could pick up whether or not plans are really separating that difference.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Todd-Melmoff, can you – I'm trying to get my head around that one. If you look at the federal law, it specifically identifies what you can set rates based on, limited – you know, here's the finite list of things that you can base rates. So how could an insurer use assume risk as a rate variation if it's not explicitly listed in the law as one of the permissible –
Our interpretation is that it's not specifically prohibited in the law, that it is something that could be considered. What is specifically prohibited in the law is that you cannot rate based on individual health status of individual people. It does not specify that you cannot rate based on product characteristics. Hmm. That said, future guidance and regulation forthcoming from HHS could have a different interpretation.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Molnoff, or Todd Molnoff. How about for small groups that would be within the exchange? To what degree are they allowed to use health rating as a group as a difference?
Sure. Representative Loeffler, if you recall, the way the exchange is going to work with respect to small groups is the employers will be essentially making a defined contribution. The rating will then occur on an individual basis. So realistically, it's a hybrid marketplace in 2014. Each individual employee will be getting a separate policy. They will no longer be part of a group plan. So the rating there, one of the questions we would have would be, do you aggregate that experience then in the small group pool or in the individual pool? You also might want to remember one of the options we obviously have to consider is combining both pools for the purposes of assessing risk. You could have a situation where both individual – remember, you are going to have groups of one, right? The new definition of small group is 1 to 100. You can have folks flipping back and forth between the individual marketplace and the small group marketplace. I think one of the things you as policymakers are going to have to decide is how do you want to address the convergence or what's feeling like the convergence of the small and the individual marketplace.
Mr. Regal, maybe I've got a basic misperception then, because I thought that groups still had the option of doing a group purchase with a selected product or going to the defined contribution approach. And that so that if a small employer right now offers coverage to their employees through a particular health plan and their employees are happy with that plan, that they could still just have that be the plan, or they could choose to go to a defined contribution approach. And are you saying that those two options no longer remain as options on the table?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, it does specify in the law that the employer may choose one plan if they so choose. So it's not prevented in the law that they could do that. The employees are also allowed to choose products under a defined contribution approach. So it is an option for an employer to choose a plan within a specified level.
And so then back to my original question, if they chose to stay with the health plan that they and their employees are comfortable with, are they still allowed to do risk rating based on the health status of that group of employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, they cannot base it on the health status of the group. They could base it on the health status of the product that's chosen by that group that would have a variety of different small groups enrolled in that particular product.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berger.
Did you mean the risk that is being borne by the product? Because a product doesn't have a health factor.
Mr. Chair.
People do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, I would just add, I think part of it is going to vary how insurers. So if you're, let's say you're a national plan, and you have product lines that are very large, you might pool by product. It's probably less likely that a plan that is specific to Minnesota geographic area from a size standpoint, that you're pooling products. You're pooling individual, you're pooling small group, but within that, it's not as, the smaller your numbers get, the less you can, you know, squeeze that into a smaller group of people. So I think it's more common, see Minnesota, where you're it's a pool of individuals or a pool of small employers within the fully insured market, but probably not pooling by product.
What are the implications, notwithstanding what Danette just said, I suppose, though, of prohibiting insurers to price based on assumed risk? So, I mean, Connecticut does that. What's the adverse implication of that, if there is one? Or what's the benefit beyond just the benefit to the insurance company?
Mr. Chair, with prohibiting based on assumed or actual risk experience of the product, what that, it reduces the risk for adverse selection by doing that.
But what, I'm talking about the reverse.
Yep.
So why would an insurance company want to pool the separate risk because they can price the product lower?
They may or may not want to do that. It may or may not be a benefit to them to do that.
And I'm just wondering why it could be a benefit. Under what circumstances would it be a benefit? Okay. All right. So it doesn't sound, and does anybody do that in Minnesota now? Any of the health plans? Segment by product? Price based on assumed risk selection? I mean, I suppose in small group plans you do all the, or do you not? That's what I'm asking the question. So you have your small group market. You rate based on the experience, right?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would perhaps ask Ms. Todd Melmov. I can't quite get my head around what's the difference between experience rating and assumed risk rating. Conceptually, they appear to be the same thing to me, and we know that we will no longer be experience rating in the future. So I don't know if Dave or Cheryl have, I can't get my head around what that looks like.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that too. Today, when we rate small group products, we have our small group pool, and we look at the pool as a whole. And because some of the products, the benefits differ, yeah, there is some differences in how those products get rated. Today, we do look at each group as I think Senator Loeffler is referring to. We look at each group separately within that pool. So the pool itself has sort of a trend increase, and then we look at the experience of the group. The larger the group, the more credible it is in terms of how we rate them. But, I'm a little confused, too.
Senator Burton.
So if they're not... if they're not rating based on individual enrollees' risk factors, but they're rating based on the experience of the product, how do they know? Do they use the previous year's product as a proxy for what the next year's risk will be?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, what a plan could do, for example, is assume that based on the characteristics of the product, that it would attract a certain type of risk, a certain type of person into that. That would be the assumed risk selection, if they assume that they would attract a certain type of risk. The actual risk experience of the product is what they would have experienced in the product the year prior. That risk or the type of risk that they incurred in that product, the claims experience that they had there to use as a basis for pricing into the next year.
I understand that. What I don't understand is when the exchange starts up, something new has been inserted into this equation. So do they use their previous risk, irrespective of the fact that we have an exchange, to assume that that's the same risk they would have in the future? Or are they able to assume a different risk factor?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, going into the future where you have an exchange versus an outside market, you could have different products that exist inside and outside that exchange. And based on what a carrier may or may not want to do regarding the pricing of that product, if they are different inside and outside the exchange, could be based on different assumptions around risk selection that they would get into those two different types of products.
But if we don't allow different products outside and inside the exchange, then they would be using their previous experience to risk rate the products?
If you allowed, if you had the same products inside and outside the exchange, this issue, this problem goes away, because you have, even though they could be using assumed risk selection between the two, you would have the same product inside and outside, so you won't be getting different segmentation of risk between an exchange and outside the exchange.
Well, Ms. Todd-Malmlove, the difference is if everybody has to have insurance, there's a group of people out there that haven't previously had insurance that will now be coming into the insurance market. And I guess the issue would be, does that change the risk?
So the question is, how are they going to set the risk once the exchange starts? Because it's going to be a different world we're moving into. So what's that process, I think, is right?
Mr. Chair, I think I may give that question over to some of the carriers that are over on the table, how they are thinking of that.
Dave has had his hand up for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the underwriting and rating that goes on today is very complex in the small group market. And you know, I don't think anybody can sit here today and actually probably predict exactly how the market will react. So I'll say what I'll say is in the context of that, today when individual groups are rated, depending on the size, they're essentially, you look at the group as a pool, but then you look at the individual experience of the group, and depending on the size, there's a certain credibility that's attached to it, actuarially speaking. There's also pooling of claims for large claims that happen in an individual group that gets spread across the entire risk pool in addition to the overall kind of community rated. So you really have multiple factors that go into setting the rate for an individual group, you know, including age, sex, all those types of characteristics. You're also looking at the experience of that group. All of those go into the actual, you know, formulas that set the premiums for the group as you roll it all up. You know, in the new world, the additional things that will be layered on top of that will be, you know, today there isn't risk sharing between carriers. There isn't an exchange that exists. So in addition to what is currently happening today, there will be, you know, specific stop-loss coverage in place for the first 3 years. There'll be risk adjustment going in. And then there also will be, I don't know if I'm using all the terms right, there'll be the reinsurance program, which essentially that will be federal dollars. This there'll be state-specific experience as well. So there's going to be layered on top of what's currently happening in the market three other risk adjustment mechanisms, and how that's all going to play out will depend, and I don't know if people are following me or not, but there's many variables that play into how this will work, and how we set up the exchange will have an impact on all of those variables, and what HHS says about what the rules are will also have a big impact, and how the Department of Commerce and Department of Health regulate the rates in the market will also have a big impact on how the market adjusts to the new reality.
Well, one of the things I'm just trying to play with in my head is like how it really rolls out. Okay, I mean, we and how much rate review and risk review will actually even be capable of as we roll this out. And one of my fears is, just as right now, at least for one period in time, I'm not sure that it's as true now as it was at one point, but it used to be for certain groups. Everybody wanted a new group in their portfolio, and so they'd offer a very nice rate for the first year to get them in, because we know inertia is just a very powerful force in the universe, and if you get a group in, they might actually stay with you for a while. And then typically your rates would bounce up while the next new group gets the discount. And, you know, we could end up with that happening in the individual market as well, only some carriers are more advantaged than others to play that game. If you decided this new law is going to require all kinds of healthy young people who have typically not been in the market to enter, everybody's going to want them in their group. And so you could undercut the price on those on your targeted group to get those new individual policies. And if you had large reserves, if you're a large carrier, you might be able to be advantaged in that rate setting for those first year or two compared to someone else, unless it's really that the pricing is related to, you know, a fair assessment of risk across the pool, across carriers. And, you know, whether we have the sophistication or not to do that, I'm not sure. But I do worry about the uneven playing field when you're launching this many new lives onto the playing field.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, you're right. That is a concern. I would note that, as Mr. Dizek pointed out, there are some mitigating mechanisms in PPACA to deal with that possibility. Risk adjustment, reinsurance, the risk corridors. I'd also add to that list of mitigating mechanisms the fact there will be a medical loss ratio that applies to the plans, to the carriers. There's a number they've got to meet. So in the past, it was worth your while to go after young, healthy population with the thought that you would eventually start paying claims on them 3 years down the road. With the medical loss ratios starting next year, and depending on what guidance HHS gives you, maybe with some degree of phase-in, that becomes a little more difficult for an underwriter to live off those returns. You have to start thinking, I got to get a more balanced portfolio of folks in my pool.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and either one, everybody in the exchange, as I understand it, will be in an individual market. And does the law require that the basic benefit set that's inside the exchange is the same as what's being offered outside, for self-insured? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, what the law requires is an essential minimum benefit set for individual and small group policies inside and outside the exchange. The requirements, for example, for self-funded employers, if they should happen to have an employee that does not get coverage through their policy or their premium is above a certain level, then they could qualify for the exchange and get that benefit set. But the requirements for the standardized products don't apply to the self-funded groups.
Could you repeat that, please?
The requirements for the actuarial values for the standardized products and for the central benefit set don't apply in the same way to the self-funded groups.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me. What I was really going at is, in the individual market, there are products sold right now without maternity coverage, and so they obviously tend to attract the women that don't think they're going to get pregnant. And what I'm concerned about is if they have the if the feds require the basic benefit set to require maternity coverage, which I would support, but and if that's not required on the outside, then you're also getting risk separation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, and this is maybe back to the earlier question around the essential benefit set as well. The essential benefits set is supposed to be based on a typical employer-based plan. So given that most typical employer-based plans include maternity coverage, the assumption is that the essential benefits set, and since that applies inside and outside the exchange for the individual and small group market, that that would likely include maternity coverage. Back to the earlier question around the essential benefits set and what we know to date, what we know from HHS is that they are in the process of doing that survey with the Department of Labor. We don't at this time know when the results of that will be done or what their time frame is for more guidance on the essential benefits set.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and still observing how the market works. Right now, typically, unless you have really adverse selection within your employee group, the belief is that even a small group of, say, 35 people will get a better price point for health insurance buying as a group than the 30 individuals going out on their own in the market. And, you know, we're going to have group sizes of 1 to 100 at some point. And so, I mean, do you envision as you juggle all of these, you know, new requirements on rating and risk sharing, things like that, that will still be true, that if you're an employer of 35 or 70 people, that you will still probably get a better collective price for your enrollees buying as a group within the exchange as you would individuals if you had an average demographic mix. I mean, if you only employ males under age 22, I suspect you'll always do better going. Well, I don't know. But, I mean, the question is there going to be an advantage to purchasing as a group within the new rules?
He's got 72 plans.
Chair Russell Loeffler, I don't know if we know the answer to that because I don't think we know. We have a good sense of what the limitations of medical underwriting are going to do to serve some of those assumptions. If you assume that the ability to rate based on medical condition is eliminated, and part of the discount you got in sort of a larger group setting as opposed to individual one-off pricing was related to that, that kind of goes away. If you also assume that part of the reason there's a price difference, and we, looking at the products, that might not necessarily be true, and that's part of the survey we, in conjunction with health, are trying to get a sense of, is there a true individual penalty, for lack of a better word? If some of the cost that drives that difference is related to the amount of paper and processing that occurs in the individual marketplace relative to the small group marketplace, that might go away in an exchange environment because now it's the same processing structure for all of those folks in the new exchange world. So that's where I guess we're not sure we can affirmatively say that the transfer from underwriting on a collective basis versus individual underwriting will mean there's a net increase to all of the participants. Certainly, as an employer, you can mitigate that by saying, rather than paying a percentage, I'm going to pay a set fee. And the set fee might be some multiple of what you were paying on a group basis, so you get your employees up and running. So if you were paying, I don't know, say $5,000 a year per employee in a group basis, you might say, starting once the exchange is up and running, I'm going to give you $5,500. And you might be on net better off than if you would have continuing buying on a group basis. So I guess the question becomes, for the employer, they have an ability to sort of manage that cost equation.
I can see where for the employer that might be attractive for the employee staying on a percentage basis of cost sharing of, say, 50-50, which is typical, and then you both are sharing medical inflation as you go forward, as opposed to a dollar amount, which may not
honor that continued traditional relationship.
True. I think that trade-off in setting up that structure for the employee, or at least the arguable trade-off, is that the relationship between your status as an insured individual and your employment status is decoupled. You no longer have to assume you need to remain employed to be insured, because you have then the ability to pick which plan works for you, which level of pricing you are comfortable with. Because the employer will say, here's the number based on a silver plan. You might decide a bronze plan works for you. So there may be some, depending on guidance for coming, there may be some return to you. Or you might think, no, I really want the silver, or I want a gold plan. So then you have the ability to make that choice.
Yeah.
Yes. Representative Loeffler, I believe you thought that individual health insurance actually costs more than group. The opposite is actually true. Individual costs much less than group insurance. And there's two reasons for that. One, there's underwriting. And two, there's not all the 68 mandates we have. So individuals about 20 to 40% less than a group plan. Okay? Now, the reason that you don't want to put both pools together is because it'll kill the individual market, because if you merge your group market and your individual market together into one pool, your individual premiums are going to shoot up. Where a lot of people think group insurance actually costs less, it's not. You could look at, you know, the rates are, you know, filed at Commerce, and you could actually see individual is a fraction of what group cost is.
For the same coverage level?
Yeah. Well, what you have is...
Because that's a big difference.
It depends on the group.
People are buying a different product as individuals.
But it depends on the... I'm sorry.
Here, let's just slow it down a little bit.
Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, it depends on the group. The risk factor, you know, what we're saying is with a group, the lowest rate's a 0.75 risk factor. The least healthy group's a 1.25. There's a 67% rate variance. So an individual policy measured against a... the highest risk is definitely way down here. But if you're in the lowest risk factor or you're in the healthiest small group, then the rates are much closer. So, you know, all I'm saying, it depends on what risk factor you are with the group. But overall, your individual plans cost less than, you know, and the big reason is because there's underwriting with it.
And we're going to this group is kind of deferring the discussion of merging the individual and the small group market to another work group that's already going forward. So that's actually not a decision that we'll be making in this group necessarily. Well, ultimately, but we're going to wait on recommendations from that group. But that's helpful. Yeah, let's, on the same subject?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the one thing I would clarify, medical underwriting is the primary reason for that, and we can't lose the fact that we've got the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association sitting out there incurring $150 million of losses, which if those got added onto the $600 million individual market would drive up the premium substantially. In the small group market, we have guaranteed issue today. We don't have that in the individual market. And so the 30,000 or 27,000 members that sit in MCHA today at some point will be redistributed into the insurance market, and it will have a fairly decent increase in the overall cost of insurance depending on where they get redistributed and depending on what the rating rules are. Keep small separate and individual separate, or are they combined?
Senator Berglund.
Well, and another difference is that the small group product is different than the individual market product. You know, usually you have some kind of a deductible that you have to meet first, and then it's an 80-20 in the individual market, and those are not necessarily the kind of products that the small group employer is offering to their employees. So there's so many differences that, you know, it's almost hard to even talk about them in comparison. And I think one of the reasons that people, besides the underwriting, prefer to be able to get coverage through an employer is because the benefits are different.
Got it.
Mr. Chair, this conversation and a few others we've had, it's very clear that it's extremely difficult to talk about one part of what's going to happen and hold other things constant. All the parts are moving. And so I've had the opportunity to work with a national group with a commercial and individual data set on some simulations broadly. And our purpose is really to look at how well the risk adjustment and reinsurance can compensate for expected selection bias constrained by the rates, the rate constraints, and then with that have a better foundation from which to actually make behavioral forecasts, you know, what's really going to happen, because at least the numbers are accounted for. And so all I'll say initially is that our first, and we've actually looked at pent-up demand and other things that we want to be concerned about, our initial look at a couple exchange scenarios give us optimism related to some of the issues brought up here. But my broader objective in this comment is maybe we can downstream share some of those simulation results. Again, they won't exactly apply, but at least it's just a simple matter of keeping track of all the moving parts. So when you're focused on one area, you remember that you're not reflecting it off of the way it was. You're reflecting it off of something else that's moving. And it's been very helpful for us nationally to look at this. So we're not ready for prime time yet, but again, when some of these are ready, maybe they could be. We could share them with health and others and help figure out how they might be informative here over time.
Thank you. That's helpful. So just to for my purposes, just to think this through, so the decisions that we would have to make as a state around this issue, is kind of aside from what's in the federal law, are whether we're going to require the same products to be sold inside and outside the exchange, and that every company has to sell the same products inside and outside the exchange, and whether we're going to require certification for outside the exchange as well as inside the exchange, and then maybe this issue of prohibiting, you know, this is pricing based on assumed risk selection. I mean, it doesn't sound like that's maybe as big a concern, but are there other things that we need to decide here as a state? I mean, is there a list of things?
Well, Mr. Chair, so we're talking about adverse selection, right?
Only an adverse selection is what I'm right. talking about, yes.
And as Mr. Knutson noted, a bunch of these assessments are interconnected to other assessments.
Yeah.
The decisions you make about adverse selection are going to impact your ability to decide what the role the exchange should play in the marketplace. And we're going to cover that now as to...
Okay, let's go to that then. Yes, Ms. O'Connell.
Could I just seek a clarification on a previous slide? It was titled PACA Exchange Adverse Selection Provisions. I'm just not sure the provisions to mitigate an adverse selection with exchanges, are these all options that a state can pick up, or are all of these the required? Are these requirements? Does my question
Mr. Chair,
make sense?
McConnell, on the slide, I think you're referring to this slide.
Yeah, this.
These are all required. They're all part
required.
Of the law. So on this last slide, and this leads you into this next piece of paper that you should have comparison here. Generally, in various circles throughout the country right now, there are discussions around three different types of roles that an exchange can play. It's either a facilitator, a selector, or a purchaser type mechanism. And this is a role for a state to decide which role it is that they want their exchange to play. Generally, and these are very general categories, and there's probably some intermeshing that could happen between the two of them, but just in terms of three broad categories, a facilitator would generally offer all products in a market and apply the certification rules to all products. They could use ratings or other, for example, quality ratings or cost ratings or other incentives to guide consumers to high-value type plans. A selector would select a limited number of plans or products that voluntarily want to participate based on various criteria such as value, and it may or may not apply the certification criteria to all products. And lastly, a purchaser could use a bidding process or some type of negotiation with health plans that want to voluntarily participate and that may or may not, again, apply certification rules to all products. So related to that, we put together a very brief kind of description of what the main components regarding adverse selection, value and affordability, competition, innovation, choice, portability and mobility, and functions and cost would relate to each of those three different types of functions that an exchange could perform. So Mr. Munsoor-Ngala and I are going to go back and forth here. We've already described kind of a description of what these three components are, so I'm going to have Mr. Munsoor-Ngala talk about adverse selection.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Todd, before you get started, can you tell me what you mean by may or may not apply certification? I mean, when Mr. Pinder talked about requirements, certification was one of the requirements. So can you sort of parcel out what you mean by
that? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what that comment means is the may or may not apply certification standards is whether or not the certification requirements would apply to all products inside and outside the exchange.
But they have to certify those inside.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Nelson.
Ms. Todd-Mamov, can you explain why that's different then for the facilitator, why you have written down here apply certification rules to all products?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, under a facilitator approach where the exchange would serve as a facilitator for all products in a market, that would essentially apply the certification rules to the entire market since all of the products would be in the exchange that are outside of the exchange.
Okay, thanks.
So you could also have a model where you don't select, but people can choose. You could be a facilitator for just part of the market, too, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, you mean for just certain products would be
allowed? Or the exchange wouldn't be affirmatively selecting or not, but you could set up a model where the insurer could decide if they're going to sell on the exchange or not. So there could be kind of
completely voluntary.
Yes.
And you could also be, Mr. Chair, you could also be a facilitator for the individual products, for example, and a purchaser for the public programs.
Right. Okay. Okay. So by facilitator, though, just so we're clear, we're talking about, in that model, everything is in the exchange, basically.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So as we take you through the exhibit, we're going to go basically left to right through each of the items. The first item I'm going to cover is adverse selection. And if you remember my adverse selection 101, adverse selection works when you've got differential products, right? So if you start with a premise under a facilitator approach that all products are in, there's very low risk of adverse selection under that scenario. The minute you start being selective and start limiting the choices, you've now created different markets outside and inside. So under a selector approach, you do have a risk of adverse selection. And that could be mitigated by, again, prohibiting insurers from using assumed risk selection and actual risk experience in product pricing. To get to Representative Loeffler's concern, one of the challenges will be, can you actually pull this off in a way that manages to, can it be implemented in such a way that you actually serve to mitigate the adverse selection risk? Purchaser approach, probably from our perspective, has the highest risk of adverse selection because by expressly limiting a bidding process, and by not requiring plans to participate, you have the possibility of steerage. Now, with the thought in mind, again, all those other adverse selection mitigation tools still apply as an overlay, but that is a concern when you set up different differential pools. So one of the decisions you have to make is the more selective you want the exchange to be, the more you're going to want to be concerned about potential adverse selection resulting from an exclusionary process.
But you could be exclusionary inside and outside the exchange too, right?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could say that again?
Where you set selection criteria inside the exchange, but you generally apply that. I don't know why anybody would want to offer outside the exchange, I suppose, in that world, but I mean, you know, I'm thinking, right, isn't that a circumstance that could where you would require the same products inside and outside the exchange, but
so you
would
set
up a floor a lot higher?
Mr. Chair, that would essentially be the facilitator approach where it would just kind of apply to everyone. So you could...
Yeah, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. For the selector and the purchaser, you could limit the number of plans offering products, but if you chose to apply the certification rules both for the in plan and out, I mean in exchange and out of exchange, that could accomplish limitation but also address the risk, adverse risk selection. So you could either use a purchaser approach with bids, or you could select what you considered value product, but whoever you chose would be required to have certification of what they offered inside and outside, and nobody else could provide that to exchange candidates. Is that, am I getting this wrong?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm going to not pronounce your last name correctly. If you did require certification requirements inside and outside the exchange, even under a selector and a purchaser approach, that would mitigate some of the adverse selection concerns. However, still, if you have different products inside and outside, there's still that potential concern of selection that exists there, even if you did do that. So next on the row is value and affordability. Under the facilitator approach, you could use ratings or other incentives to direct consumers to high-value plans, products, and providers. Under the selector approach, you could get at value and affordability by limiting the participants to those that had the highest value plans and products, and thus, you know, direct consumers to those plans and associated providers. Under the purchaser approach, you could get at value and affordability by negotiating greater discounts or more services through a bidding or negotiation type approach, and thus direct consumers to those plans and associated providers in that way. But at this point, it's unclear to us right now how the single risk pool applies if the exchange is a purchaser. It's difficult to understand how that applies if they would be negotiating further discounts, how that single risk pool applies there. It's hard for us to it's a little unclear for us how that works with states that are contemplating the exchange as a purchaser.
Because you'd get the greater discount because you'd be adjusting for risks differently?
The purchaser, if they could negotiate with the exchange to get those greater discounts, it's unclear if the plan offered the same product outside the exchange, if those things would still apply outside the exchange or not. And because when you're negotiating additional discounts around that, it in a sense kind of becomes a separate pool. So it's just hard to understand how the single risk pool provision of that applies.
Mr. Chair, you know, I'm struggling a little bit, probably because just having looked at this, how it feels a little limiting to put this into these three different structures when really there's likely nuances of them that would make more sense. And one of the things that I'm struggling with on this whole bidding process is something plans with a lot more experience than my plan has and Medicare Advantage could probably speak to. But the concept of this, you know, voluntary and having this bidding negotiation, I think you could end up with a situation where you didn't have a lot of options inside the exchange. You know, I think this whole idea of bidding works well with national organizations that perhaps have a lot more margin in where they have room for bidding more. You know, certainly with our dual eligible or MSHL products, it's turned to be, you know, problematic in some of those areas. And I don't have experience with Medicare Advantage plans, others could speak to that. But it just feels like these are kind of limited in how we're looking at. I'm just having a hard time kind of getting my head around these three vacuums here, perhaps. But I'm sorry, please continue.
a couple other questions.
Well, Mr. Chair and April, I'm wondering, is this the purchaser method? Is this the way that California is intending to go with what they passed in those two bills just recently? Are they going down the purchaser route?
Mr. Chair, and I'm going to mispronounce your last name too, Froland?
Froland.
California recently passed legislation that essentially sets up a facilitator type approach, but it allows the exchange, it gives them the authority to do a purchaser or a selector type of mechanism. So it gives them that authority. It doesn't necessarily say you must do this. It just allows for the ability to do so.
Okay.
Philip.
Mr. Chair, I believe in the California law that Governor Schwarzenegger just signed, they talk about it as selective contracting, but I believe that's essentially referring to what within our set of three categories here would be the purchaser function.
Well, I think the greatest hopes for all of this reform is that value and affordability will become the basis of most choices. So of this whole list, this is the one that I think has the most hopes on it. And I think it's the one that we really need to think through carefully the options and look through a really broad range of how to approach this, because I think there are ways to potentially do it. And I just think of the Medicare Part D and what, you know, seniors are so hopeful that they were going to finally have help with prescription costs, and they ended up in the biggest nightmare that I think consumers have ever been subjected to in healthcare decision making, in terms of having way too many plans, too confusing, no guarantee that the current offerings will be sustained. And you know, I think that we need to look at lessons learned from that process as we're trying to figure out how do we design the system to achieve the hopes of the public, that value and affordability will be enhanced. And it may be that there's a lot of nuanced ways to do this, more than I think this is helpful in terms of thinking about broad big picture goals, but I really think that's something I would like to see us spend some time figuring out with all the tools in front of us, how to enhance that.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go to the next bullet, competition, innovation, and of course, an editorial comment. I think Ms. Coleman's right. These are fairly broad buckets. We're just trying to give you a 20,000, 30,000 perspective of sort of how different approaches may have an impact on some of your ability to do some of these things. Certainly, a purchaser approach is probably the most blunt instrument to get to a value proposition. But you could do it through technology in a facilitator role. You could still set up a structure where consumers are assisted or guided to value purchasing decisions without having to be a purchaser. But with that as editorial, I'm sorry. All right, so competition innovation. If you maximize participation and transparency, we would assume that it would facilitate competition. It becomes a lot easier for plans to come to our marketplace. So the ease of entry into our market would be reduced. And there may be more innovation if the exchange allows plans to be a little more creative relative to what they do with, and this is all that everything depends on other things, network adequacy and essential health benefit structures are going to have impact the ability to be innovative, but to the extent they allow for innovation, a facilitator approach may encourage more innovation, more competition, quicker access to marketplace.
Senator Berger.
So I take it when you use the words innovation, you're thinking about the insurer side of the equation, not the provider side of the equation.
Primarily, Madam Chair, you're correct. Primarily, that is our thought process, though now that you bring that up, you may see hybrid partnership products coming out or coming into the exchange that reflect input from facilities and providers that may not otherwise be possible if you set up a purchaser or selector approach that for closest ability to kind of come up with those hybrid products. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, so I apologize. You may have a product that offers a health insurance benefit, but it's tied to a fitness coaching component or is tied to a weight reduction program that's in partnership with a facility. If you have an approach that says all the products that are going to be sold here, like in a selector or purchaser approach, should meet the following criteria, you may not, in setting up that criteria, allow for that sort of hybrid product to be offered.
Well, but the other extreme is possible also by being a selector or being a purchaser. You might be encouraging those products to be developed more quickly than they would be otherwise. Or you might be encouraging them to be created where they wouldn't have been created at all otherwise.
Because of the scale associated with the market? Or?
Right.
That's correct.
So, you know, I think when you're looking at the insurer side, you're not looking at the payment reform side in making up this chart. I think that's perhaps
actually,
a limitation of the chart.
Mr. Munson-Ragoa.
Actually, Madam Chair, if you look at our next two buckets, we do acknowledge that one of the advantages for being a selector or purchaser is that you can use the selection or bidding process to drive towards that value proposition. To the extent that you make that a selecting criteria, that the access be to higher value providers and higher value facilities, that's clearly the value in having a more selective process of allowing folks into the exchange. I think that would be the major advantage of being a selector or purchaser.
Well, Mr. Chair, to your example, though, I can think of an example where the state, as the purchaser for the public programs, purchasing health coverage under MA from the health plans, has a very clear purchaser role, but it has allowed those kind of variations within that. I can think of one health plan that, for example, was offering as a benefit limited use, you know, limited numbers, cell phones, to enrollees because they realized that a major problem from discharging someone to the hospital in somewhat unstable condition is that they lived in communities in which there weren't pay phones and the person being discharged didn't have access to a phone to call if there were problems or they needed to consult with a nurse. And so even within a purchasing plan, you can allow for some variations, whether it's that special weight loss program or something else. And so I think that there can be more flexibility within a purchasing model because we've done that already in at least in that example. And so I think, you know, it's stretching all of our minds to kind of think about each of these options and what the full range is. But
so I think that then the next row on here is related to choice. And this one is kind of an easy one. We're under the facilitator. It maximizes the choice of products. May make choice a bit harder because there are quite a few choices there, and it, you know, makes it harder for consumers to choose. But you could use more IT functionality to help consumers make those comparisons and help them make that choice. Under the selector role, this limits the choice of products, so it may make it easier for consumers to actually pick and compare products, and it would require less IT functionality to actually compare those products. And those same things also apply under the purchaser model where you have a limited choice of products but easier to compare and wouldn't need as much IT functionality to allow those comparisons. Portability? Okay, I guess I'll do the portability one next, too. Portability and mobility. Under the facilitator approach, if you have all of the products in the exchange, it allows the consumers, if they're in the exchange, to keep the plan that they like it from year to year. So as opposed to under the selector or purchaser approach, if the one product maybe isn't in there the next year, then they'd have to change their plan. That's one thing that the facilitator approach does. It also would potentially promote longer-term consumer and plan relationships and care management if they're allowed to keep their plan longer over time. Under the selector approach, the reverse of that is that if the plans change from year to year, consumers may not be able to keep the plan that they want in the exchange to also keep their subsidy, and may not encourage as long as a term relationships over time. These same things would also apply under the purchaser model as well. So you have a trading balance here with the mobility and portability.
And then the last conversation we have is about function and cost. So if you're a facilitator, you don't incur the cost of plan selection, negotiation, or contracting functions, or at least it's a reduced expenditure. You may end up having to spend more on IT if you want to help with providing or helping consumers navigate through the process. The analogy we've heard from some folks is, you know, they'll get a telephone book of all the plans that are being offered, and that's not particularly helpful to the consumer. You could help streamline that process by providing what essentially amounts to drop-down screens to help filter the choices. So by the time you're done, you're down to 3 to 4 to 5 plans. With selectors and purchasers, the flip side would occur. You're going to have to or will likely incur more admin costs related to contracting, plan selection, negotiation. There may be a savings relative to IT because you won't have to be supporting as many products, companies, et cetera, as you would otherwise under a facilitator approach. But that's how we would view sort of the trade-offs between the three different approaches. And again, recognizing that we're giving you somewhat simplistic and admittedly extreme versions of all three types of approaches. Clearly, a lot of exchanges are going to sort of fall into hybrids or some combination of these functions.
Yeah, great.
Yes, under choice, this is actually the first time I've been given information that there's actually would be more choice if all products would have to go through the exchange. What I've been reading is if you want more choice, you would have plans in the exchange and plans outside of the exchange, because the exchange is going to most likely limit the number of products, where if you're outside the exchange, you could have many products. Right now, there's well over 150 group contracts that employers could choose from among the carriers. So I'm just saying, if we just have the exchange and now we cut it down to, say, 30 or 40, and you don't have anything outside the exchange, that's going to really disrupt the private market out there in regards to plan selection.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. DiCillo, I think when we said there's greater choice in a facilitator approach,
okay,
that's relative to an exchange as a purchaser or a selector. If you had no qualifying criteria in the first place, that's the marketplace as it is today. But if you have to meet certain criteria to get into the exchange, you're right, that acts as a filter. I guess our point is, with a facilitator, that becomes the only screening tool you use. And beyond that, you don't contract for value. You don't ask for any additional add-ons on top of sort of the minimal requirements to get to be an exchange plan.
So you would be able to buy plans outside of the exchange. It's just that the exchange would be approving, like right now, Commerce approves everything. So the exchange would become the approver of all plans, but not all plans would have to be inside of the exchange.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Hulley.
Mr. Chair and the two witnesses there, on the portability and mobility buckets, I think I disagree a little bit with the selector and purchaser. While I would agree that there's you might not stay with the same insurance company for a long time, but I think most people make their decision about whether their doctor is in which health plan. And not, I mean, I only care as whenever I get these choices every year, it's, which one covers the Duluth Clinic? And to be honest, it doesn't make much difference to me if it's Health Partners or Blue Cross Blue Shield or Medica. I don't care about the insurance plan. I care about the doctor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that's probably the case today. I would suggest that one of the possible changes that could occur from PPACA is the ability for a plan to reap the financial benefits of wellness programs becomes more enhanced. So if I'm a plan, I'm thinking about actually between risk adjustment and reinsurance, maybe I actually want to try to see if I can market to diabetics because I'm confident my network will get them healthier. And now if I'm one of those enrollees, I might go, that plan did a good job of dealing with me between coaching and guidance and, you know, a coordination of care. I want to stick with them. So I guess what I'm positing is that you're right. The relationship right now is between the provider and the enrollee. I suspect we're going to see that the relationship may start including a third party in there to the extent that plans bring value to the equation. If they don't bring value to the equation, you're right. There's no incentive or reason for someone to want to stay with a particular plan.
Hey, Mr. Chair and witnesses, can you give me an idea of the scope of the difference between a facilitator and a purchaser selector? When reading through the Wisconsin document, they have 40 plans in Wisconsin. How many plans in Minnesota are there? And what, I mean, I'm thinking about simplicity for the enrollees. If you have, you know, the world to choose from, it makes it a lot more complicated than if you have selected plans. What are we talking about as far as how it would?
Mr. Chair, we can probably both answer this from different perspectives. I'm just responding to the Health Department does a survey of individual and small group products. We do it every couple of years as just a monitoring of the market. And based on that, I think in our last survey we had between the two markets maybe 500 or so products between the two, representing about 95% of the market. I don't know if you have a...
So now that's page. Products. How many
products.
Sales, how many health plans were selling those 500 products?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Catholic, that depends on how you define the phrase health plans, because obviously each plan has separate subsidiaries under their family structure. We would think that depending on which market you're looking at, the active participants, folks who are actually trying to make a marketplace, differs from maybe 9 to 15 active. And with respect to sort of the potential for consumer confusion from the variety of plans out there, one of the things you can do, again, is to use technology to leverage guiding, narrowing, focusing consumer choice. If to start with Representative Huntley's perspective, the most important thing to you is your doc in the network. That's a pretty big filter right there that knocks off a bunch of plans. Then your next one might be, I want this hospital in my network. That knocks out a bunch of the plans. I'm interested in this level of copay that further narrows the plans. And the thing we don't know is HHS is meeting with all of the existing exchanges right now, with Utah, with Massachusetts. We don't know what beyond what Utah is doing now HHS is going to say is the minimum necessary to comply. So once we know how far you can go towards a facilitative role, then I think our conversation gets a little more focused. But until we know what they're willing to accept on sort of the one end of the spectrum, we're not sure where we can move from there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm curious whether there's an opportunity in the exchange to do anything related to, for example, high value. Let me back up a second. I mean, we've gone through an ebb and flow over years in terms of broad networks, narrow networks, and the reality is we have to maintain access to primary care everywhere in the state, and it's going to limit the ability to be too selective, I'm guessing, in the selective role. Are there other possibilities in this electoral to do to open the door to plans that are minimally certified or qualified, but also some create some soft steerage into high value plans, or do we not have any option like that?
Mr. Chair, I would say that there are, yes, those would be optional things that are there. For example, whether it's a, you know, under a facilitator or a selector role, you could, through the rating, guide them into certain types of, you know, products that are that have certain types of networks or certain types of providers. You could also put in there different types of incentives or additional state subsidies or something along those lines to direct them to, like, reduce their cost sharing for certain types of providers in the networks of certain types of plans. So there's a lot of different, I think, creative things
that you can do. That's possible is what you're suggesting.
You know, there's a lot of things that are creative and open to,
Okay. Thank you.
As you're saying, this bucket is very high level.
One more question.
Well, mine's not very substantive, so.
No, go ahead.
Maybe I should defer to Philip.
Oh, we can do two more. I didn't see your hand. Okay, two more.
Mine is a really basic question, but sometimes people talk about plans, and sometimes they talk about products, and then I think plans are one thing, and then I think products are one thing, and then I get confused. Is products? So I was thinking plans provider. And product, the different types of offerings that or products that they offer, but is that right? Or
Mr. Chair, Ms. Conley's right. We tend to use plans to refer to the companies and the products they offer, the different portfolio of policies they have in the marketplace. But sometimes you're right. Sometimes we slip and we'll use them interchangeably. Maybe we should just say the companies and their products, and that would be clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a little more in the spirit of an opinion or a position than a question for the witnesses, but in part in response to the question that was just raised, it seems to me that in the selective contracting or active purchaser, one of these three models, it's not just price that you could be delivering an incentive to the insurers to compete on through that bargaining process. There would also be other options around network advocacy and essentially any plan characteristic you chose. I mean, the enabling or the legislation that was just passed in California does not define at all sort of what criteria would be used in the selective contracting, and I think that is very much in the spirit of what that active purchaser role is, because if you compare it to the selector model here, it's hard to see where the incentive is in the selector model to exceed whatever minimum requirements, however extensive they are set by the exchange, whereas in the active purchaser role, there would be some incentive, whether it's on the network, you know, coverage, whether it's on the price, or other plan characteristics. That's, you know, one among a number of reasons that I think that the active purchaser role is the best way for the state of Minnesota to go. It's an analogous situation. It's not the same situation, but essentially, you know, when large self-insured employers are bargaining with health plans, they're utilizing the bulk purchasing power of, you know, all of the people who are covered. And similarly, when public employees through the state are bargaining with health plans, they're utilizing their bulk purchasing power to achieve whatever goals they set, you know, among those different sort of criteria through the bargaining process. And it seems to me like actually Representative Loeffler raised a sort of interesting, again, it's just an analogy, but an interesting sort of analogy for this, that when Medicare Part D was created under the Bush administration, it was created with a prohibition for the federal government to bargain over the prices of the pharmaceuticals. And, you know, I think that was a disastrous mistake. And I think that there's sort of an analogous situation here, that if we're going to be certifying the plans and setting all of these market rules, it's hard for me to understand why we wouldn't want the state to use some of that bulk purchasing power to achieve, you know, whatever goals we decide. And I think that cost and quality seem like the ones that most people agree upon around this table that we decide that we want to pursue.
Mr. Chair, I realize that was in the spirit of an editorial comment, not a question, but I do have a short response. I would concur that bidding is probably the best way to achieve those goals. I would differ on an assumption that you couldn't achieve that in a facilitated process. If, for example, value is an outcome you want to steer people to, one of the things that you can do is make that the first filter in the selection process for a consumer. And first filters tend to have some, how do I put this, scale in terms of driving people's decisions. So the first pick they have to select is between 1, 2, or 3-star plans. Consumers tend to want to pick the best thing they can get. So I guess what I'm suggesting is I concur with you that a bidding or selector process skins that cat a lot quicker, but I would suggest there are other ways to skin that cat.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one response on that. Speaking with people on the Massachusetts Connector, they actually initially rolled it out with many more options, even with within the connector, than it has today, and that was based on the sort of basic behavioral economics proposition that when you throw a lot of different choices at people, and I understand your point about the drop-down menus and the possibility that IT is going to sort of get us past those, but there's a basic obstacle there for consumers, especially consumers who are accessing these products for the first time, to make meaningful comparisons among the products. I think that the experience, the sort of lesson learned in Massachusetts, as I understand it anyway, is that limiting the number of choices and the characteristics that differ among those choices was very helpful in their assessment in terms of, just improving the functioning of their exchange.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think one thing that we want to think about is we want to be careful that we are not deciding what individuals value, that we are letting individuals decide what it is that they value. So depending on what a competitive bidding price may be set up on, let's say it's just price. And so which is how some procurement processes, it's very driven by what the price is. And you may have some individuals who don't want the characteristics of a plan that are driven by the lowest price. There may be other characteristics of a plan that they can choose, that they can afford, and they don't want that to be the characteristic that they choose over. Or other individuals who are very comfortable with a narrow network, particularly if their doctor is in that network. And I think we have the capability, and I think some plans are beginning to go down the road of much more collaborative relationships with providers. You're going to see a lot more, I think, narrow networks, and so appreciate the comments that were made to make sure that HHS doesn't define network adequacy to say that, it has to be everybody in. But so I would just be a little bit careful with this, blunt tool of the purchaser that we're not putting onto the public what they value, and we're keeping options open for people to choose what it is they value.
Mr. Chair, I might also add that, building on those comments, that when you do put the exchange in the position of defining and bargaining for the plan, they then become the person that does decide what individuals want, and the individuals no longer then steer health plans to innovate new ways to meet whatever they might value. I can think of, for instance, I believe Medica offers programs through Optum Health that give services to people who are in a crisis situation where, when they're in that crisis situation, they found out they have cancer, where do I go, who can I talk to? They actually provide services that help them sort through those a lot of the really important decisions that people with cancer have to make, including their doctor. You might have a great primary care doctor, but at that point, that doctor doesn't matter anymore in many regards. And, there's a lot of innovations, I think, that we, building what Manny Munson-Regala had mentioned as far as in regards to what Representative Huntley was talking about, that there's a lot of innovations that we might see in the future. And I'm really excited to see all these innovations that we might see in the future when individuals start talking to their insurers and saying, look, hey, wouldn't it be great if your product did this for me? And if the exchange is the purchaser, the health plans are going to be looking to the exchange to ask, what do you want us to do? And I really hope that the consumer stays in that role.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say in response to that that certainly the idea of an exchange is not to establish a single health plan and then steer everybody towards it. And so it's the meaningful distinctions among those plans and the choices that consumers have within the exchange is the whole point of setting up an exchange. So I think, you know, we all wouldn't be here sort of working on exchange design if we didn't think that that kind of consumer choice was useful. You know, the question was raised earlier about sort of how many insurers, how many different products are within these markets right now. And in my reading anyway of just the data that's available on the Department of Health's website is that if you sort of look at the families of insurers rather than sort of all the subsidiary kinds of products in the individual market, because I don't think the Department of Health produces the publicly available information on the small group market, at least that I've found, but on the individual market in Minnesota currently, it looks to me, and maybe please correct me if I'm wrong on this, that it breaks down to somewhere around 80 to 90% of the individual market is three insurers, and that there may be a lot of variation, you know, of products within those three. So I think realistically, the whole sort of concept of competitive markets that are driving innovation, you know, is it's tricky to apply that to this kind of market with the kind of market power that's in the market. And we really have to think about setting up the exchange in a way that is going to allow individuals and small employers who have been, you know, trying to deal with those market power holding insurers at the level of an individual or a group of 30 people, something like that, the ability to pool their purchasing power to have a little bit more leverage in that interaction, in that transaction. That's my understanding anyway of, you know, a big part of the rationale for setting up a health insurance exchange. Realistically also, you know, how likely is it that we're going to have an exchange that is set up in a way that's so rigid that it excludes, you know, those three insurers that currently account for, if I'm reading the data correctly, 80 to 90% of the individual insurance market, you know, probably not very realistic, I think. So, you know, I think that it makes sense for us not to proceed from kind of the assumption that through the kind of disaggregated consumer power in this market, we would somehow trigger enhanced competition and innovation, because it's a market with natural economies of scale that lead to market power.
All right. Any closing remarks you have on your stuff? Okay. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to thank the two presenters that did just a fantastic job today. The material that they put together is probably the most complicated thing we ever had to deal with, and they try to get it down to something we can get our hands around, and it's going to take me a while to get there, but I want to thank you two for your presentation. It was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks to everybody around the table today for engaging in the conversation. This is and if you look at the kind of how we're proceeding, we'll probably get back to making some decisions around some of these functions in about three meetings from now. But next meeting, we're going to talk about some of the reinsurance and risk adjustment issues, kind of, and that's among plans as opposed to outside and inside the exchange is really, I think, the distinction. And then some of the financing issues. We're changing the order a little bit to accommodate some presenters. But so thank you very much. And with that, we are adjourned.
Either way.
I know.
Once for a week, it was a kind of crazy summer. And
Okay. Oh, yeah, you're a health partner.
actually, this is the guy.
Was it the same section?
Yeah. Back in when Medicare.
I know. I highlighted and read it last week. That's
experts were out there, like, and Bob, I think you and maybe.
I read that.
It's the from Kaiser,
the letter. Of the
it's like the 99.
You guys kind of. Plan industry, say, I think, saves risk.
Yeah, I've been sitting
back here. I didn't say I didn't see you out there.
I think that's the biggest concern. How do you know? I think
I mean, there's so much.
The collective is
fairly.
Well, in that, I mean, I think that it's just a huge problem for us.
You have your biases here.
Oh, no,
see you again.
Yeah. Risk adjustment for next meeting.
That's nice. Okay. Well, I'll just wait for you.
I did ask one.
That's the problem is that I'm out of that company. Who would have got to miss the whole time?
Oh, that's my baby.
That's my baby. So it's maybe just passes. We have a little simulation. All the pieces fit together. Diagnosis, risk adjuster. Types. You showed it at the meeting. Do some other things. Be one of those kind of data sets. That's a different scenario. And the RAND people, we've got with them.
Really good discussion.
I was going to say, do you have a card? I'd love to get together
with
you
sometime. It's no big deal yet.
We'll talk to you later. That's awesome.
I really like that one.
See you.
Well, just get like 6 months
and it's already. And I would only get. I would have looked at house.
Society of Acts, for instance. Sat with a bunch of park people. Those guys ran numbers to get wacky coefficients. This is G model and said, okay, now drug use, ICD codes predicted. That was just a fun project. But going back to the old days, there were all kinds of how infeasible. And you know, it's all partially true. For some reason, slowing down some risk adjustment usually understandable for best risk. Have to see what the error environment is. Exchange that you've got something saying, wait a second. Anyway, that's your concerns, whatever they would be really like to see the feds standardize guidance. Would be very useful if you already written that down. Just starting to. Remember, this was a bunch of John Burko, who's at that meeting, it was decided to reach out it's still a question who's going to be the risk management parameter. I think it's going to be Osio, but well, the question is what kind of standards should be. That's it. Yeah, that's why I never bring that. Right now, I don't even hint, especially because we're going to peer review. So it's something we just never hint that there's any abuse because people come, oh man, that thing is so great, we should use it for this. And I say, and
Lynn Blue wasn't
here. You know, I think we needed another year of safe use of that. And then, potentially explore it.
One more thing.
But we're going to have risk scores on everybody. You ask me about this cross-peer data. I'm actually
here, Greg. So. I found it.
It's amazing. So, but anyway, the bottom line is it
right here.
So does attitude about
This is where
I saw that same thing too. But here, but think about this though. Okay, so where this is going?
I don't remember the context of the conversation. I think it was during Tom's, right?
It was during Tom's, and he was talking about their roles in purpose. And their ability to bargain.
Yeah.
Their ability to bargain on price.
But remember, the way I would read this is that you can't impose new roles on them. You can require additional services to be sold on time. Right?
Yeah.
That's a filter.
So maybe you already have.
Yeah, certainly.
You have any special access?
As far as I know, a lot of projects
really can't continue for at least 4 months.
So you may say that with a raw, at the end of the year, which comes in as ratings, right? And then peer required.
Yeah, what you realize.
And for which
peer rating, you could limit.
You're asking for more details than what they're giving, or you're saying they want to get down to the some
of these
plans.
Oh, no. Back premium.
Because we're really starting to get into these
details.
That's HHS. Yeah, so you got Melinda Button.
Aren't you?
Okay, I can do that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're.
Yes. I mean, but that's
not really. That's not.
Yeah, it would be.
That's not.
I mean, the two risk adjustment and when I say risk adjustment, eligible bunch, technical knowledge, issues, reinsurance, and risk adjustment.
But
now
you're purchasing.
Melinda.
Maybe produce the wrong term. Maybe
it's working for.
So that's why
section of HHS, but she's on Mona. So temporarily work on risk adjustment.
It's even more. You're tapping.
But isn't that what Selector?
And Jeff Grant. Jeff Grant.
Selector says only health plans that have providers in this value.
But Jeff Grant and Asylum.
Except
so it's exclusive.
I know that's what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
She said,
She said it. Well, that's, and you got to do that. But talking about the next.
I think it's allowed. I don't think, I'm not sure I would recommend it's a policy outcome, but
yeah.
I don't think this prohibits
that outcome. Assistant Secretary.
I think you
Asper.
Could, yeah, you could say that. But they can't put a control on
it. So he's merely a policy guy, but he very methodologically strong, obviously,
because
and some key issues, actuarially, and kind of metrics and that sort of thing. So there's a few people like that. Those are ones that get. They can translate nanosecond, some technical or. Something about data into it means something to me. So
whatever is important.
All right.
Talk about all that.
So should I?
So where's your selection?
I'll do that, and then I'll just give you a little bit more about this. The simulation we're working on.
And how are the kids adjusting?
Again, pretty basic right now, but it might be useful.
His buddies.
Give us a call if you want to get over there and have a unit.
Really fun doing extra people's jobs.
Kate.
I mean, it's not that. Yeah, there's not that much to do. There's not that much happening, but it's just. But Laura in sales has gone to our DFL researcher, left in September. So I was already doing those two.
Jim is just going to come talk.
Okay.
And he has a presentation. He's not going to just going to have talk and not do a PowerPoint. That's all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if there's I don't object.
Conversation that he and Huntley want to have, or he and Tyson, he could share some of those talking points with him. But
that's fine.
Because it's a broader audience.
Well, actually, no. Now that I say that, I got to go back and just say they were saying if we got the declaration today, it's going to be.
All right.
We didn't get it today. So I guess we'll find out. Hey.
What?
I understand those.